The title of the talk is Mindfulness and the Senses, and how we can cut through illusion. Can you hear me at the back? Not so well. Maybe you can increase the sound. Is it better? Any better? You tear it off? So we have a possibility for seeing life from the point of view of life, or from the point of view of me as a person living and looking at life. From the point of view of life, life is absolutely free, is infinite, is open, is a joyful dance. I'm experiencing that these days with a new grandchild, that in between breastfeeds, this new child, this new boy, is blissfully open, free, infinite. And then the need for tsitsi, hanaka, appears. And it comes down back into a personal point of view. I need something. So I have these joyful early morning times with this new grandchild. But we all have hints all the time of this place of the life point of view. And the hints of places of joy, of freedom, of simplicity, of openness, and of okayness, of perfection. And the hints are rather subtle, and they often get drowned by the human or subjective or the me story, which is based on life is a problem. And that the me itself is a construction built to deal with problems, to survive. We understand it conceptually as well. And I want to read a poem written by a British Dharma teacher called David Brazier. It's intellectual, it's a concept about this freedom, but it does give us a sense, because we understand it, we actually know that freedom that he's talking about. And it's quite relevant. It's a beautiful poem that is relevant to our practice here. The poem is called Where Were You Last Year? Breathe deep, the air fills my lungs, and then my blood receives this grace through which I live a few moments more, my every cell renewed. With every breath, a part of me departs and something new is put in place. The rice I ate today, where is it now? In my muscles, in my bones. The juice that we shared, where has it gone? In our arms and legs and all. And last month, the rice waved in the sunshine in other lands, in the low flood plains of the Mississippi, and the fruit hung on trees in Cyprus or Spain. And before that, their substance was in the soil, was in the air, was in the seas, waiting to be gathered up, waiting to soar up into the highest reaches of the sky, and waiting to become rain. You and I are mostly water. Last year, most of each of us was in the ocean. We circulated together in the Atlantic or the Pacific, for we are mostly water. And that water was lifted by sunshine, heat, cascading down, beating upon the face of the ocean. And every photon comes from the sun, from the belly of the star. So you and I were stars last year. We chased each other in the turbulent heart of the sun. So who was it that lived in your house last year? And where will you be next week? Who is your true friend and who is not? And who will you be next year? Breathe deep, breathe deep. This air is me, this air is you, this air we share. I give my substance to you and you yours to me. With each breath, I am linked in a single orbit, this means a single circle, with the great forests. My out-breath is their food, and theirs fills my lungs. Last year I was a tree, and the tree was me. Each day we gather up substance and continue the task of endlessly remaking ourselves from one another. Each day we let go a portion and continue the cycle of endlessly returning ourselves to others. Day by day we change and we become one another, the substance of the universe, star dust and all passing through each of us and we through it. So where were you last year? Breathe deep, breathe deep. We can know that and understand it. We have this knowledge in us. But it's heavily covered over, and it's covered over by our constructions, by our tendency to build story, difficulty, and ourselves. It's not our fault. The Dharma says that everything, every being is doing it. The universe is creating subjectivity. The universe is creating an ant and an insect and a person, all who in their own way think of themselves as separate from the universe. So it's the universe's fault, not ours, that we think we're a person. Or an ant thinks of itself as a person, as an ant. In bracket Sograim, I just remember this quote from Frank Zappa, who said, stupidity is one of the properties of the universe. So we're seeing something which is, in the Pali language, it's called ahamkara, meaning the tendency of the universe to create selfing, the illusion of self in us. So we don't need to blame ourselves for our constructions. This is the nature of things. We are making objects and forms which we believe to be real. And we are the main object that we believe to be real. It's about embodiment, being dropped into a body. Now, we didn't do that, the universe did it. But we arrived in a body and everything else runs after that. All the constructions and all the selfing and all the things that we believe to be true. And it's basically because the world is a risky place, the world is threatening, and we've built mechanisms to try and understand the world, to try and deal with the world and to stay alive. And these mechanisms are the point of view of me struggling to stay alive, not the point of view of life. So We can cut through all of that by seeing it, by seeing. And this is the emphasis, this is the basic practice of the Dharma. To see the way things are and not just to believe that that's the way things are. So seeing takes the place of believing. There is a very nice traditional story of a king who is sitting in his castle, but he believes himself to be king and king of all the lands and the kingdom out there. In actual fact, he's shut in his castle, sitting on his throne, feeling like king, but at the same time being totally imprisoned, because his castle is nothing but walls. And this is us. We think we are the kings of our life, but actually we're rather shut in walls. However, the good news, according to the story, is that there's a little window open high up on one of the walls, and a small bird comes in. And the bird comes to bring good news that you're not actually totally in prison. And the two wings of the bird are made of, one wing is mindfulness and the other wing is samadhi, concentration or calmness. So mindfulness and calmness, the bird comes and whispers to the king, actually you're free. So that's traditional story, and that's where we are and that's why we're here. So mostly we limit our ability to see clearly what's going on. And the reason is that we have a kind of automatic process of saying, well, this I don't need to pay attention to because it's not a problem. And that I don't need to pay attention to because I don't need to deal with that. I do need to deal with my head, and I do, if I have a headache, I have to pay attention to my head. If I don't have a headache, then I don't need to know that I have a head. I don't need to know that I have a hand, as long as I can do something with it. So we limit our vision according to the needs that we have of coping, hitmodudut. So that's that. In normal life, we just respond. We're responding all the time to what's needed for our survival, for being better, for being okay, for coping, for managing, for dealing with problems that have come up or that might come up. Mindfulness takes us in another direction. It takes to pieces these automatic processes of coping, responding, and not seeing. It actually takes things to pieces. It deconstructs the constructions we make around life. Mindfulness cuts through the constructions. Because it's not actually about coping. It's about seeing things as they really are, as they are. Including, I have a head now, and there's no headache. Let me look at it. Now I have a head, and there is a headache. It's unpleasant. Both we see deeply, the head which is pleasant and the head which is unpleasant. So that immediately cuts through our tendency to respond, react, deal with, cope with life, and close down the vision. What's the truth of this moment is mindfulness. Shine the light on this moment. What is really happening right now is mindfulness. There's less processing. There's no history or time. It doesn't really matter who we are. We can be, like I said in the walking, we can be a grandfather or a child. It's not interesting. We can be a millionaire or we can be without a penny in our pocket. Who cares? So there's less processing going on, there's less history, there's less story or biography, there's less belief. We can get some immediate relief from the pains of life when we address and direct mindfulness towards painful states of mind. And this is where mindfulness has become extremely useful and powerful in the new psychotherapies that we're seeing today, CBT, ACT, and I won't go into that right now, but there's a whole radical change happening, or happened already, in psychotherapy, using mindfulness to light up states of mind and see that they don't need to control us. And when we think of the states of mind that you and I have, because we all have them, the tendencies, whatever they are, of judgment, of ego, of victim, of anger, of fear, of anxiety, of loads of stuff. But when we look at them, there is an immediate way in which we can sense freedom. We look at them, we deconstruct them, we believe them less, and that opens space in the mind. If we, for example, have, like an old story of mine way back, a fear, and in my case it was fear of speaking in front of public. Well, it's obvious that I don't have it anymore. Nothing left. But I did. Panic. But that was a long time ago when I started to practice Dharma. But I understood that if I gave belief and legitimacy to the fear of speaking in front of people, it just stayed year after year. But if I saw it as a phenomena and not interesting anymore, just a phenomena, it slowly disappeared. So I would just simply concentrate on the tummy. Every time I had to speak in public, I would concentrate on the tummy. There was a phenomena, not interesting, just the tummy, mitkavetz, contracted stomach. That was what was happening. That's all it was. By seeing clearly as a phenomena and not as a big story that I believed, it went. And mind states can go if we go into this phenomenological tofa'atiyut, I don't know how to say it, this phenomenological way of looking at our experience. It's just phenomena arising and passing, without weight, without control, without drama, without belief that they are real. So as we do this, the breath and the body, as we practice here together, are good places to start. And we're obviously learning this now and remembering it because we've been through retreats before, but they're simply good, solid places to practice deconstruction of the constructions that we make around the world and us. The body is just simply a very good field where we can practice deconstruction, seeing things as they arise and as they pass away. It's just simpler. But we can deal with it in the mind too, of course. The mind is another good place. It's just more complex or more subtle. And we get caught a bit more easily. So body and breath are good places to begin. And the Buddha was very clear about seeing things phenomenologically. He said in Satipatthana Sutta, it's just fine to simply know there is a body. Well, that's already a huge difference between my body, which I want to be in a certain way, and I like it like this or not like that, or it hurts me, it doesn't hurt me, 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 and I, it's an old body, it's a young body, it's a this body, it's a that body, it's a fat body, a thin body. There is a body. This is no different from it's raining. That's all it is. There is a body. That already cuts through a huge amount of projections and constructions and beliefs. There is a body. My arm is moving. Movement is happening. Very simple. That's mindfulness, cutting through the constructions. And it's internal and external, as it says in the Satipatthana Sutta. We are responding to the craziness of life out there by entering a retreat. And we're making things a bit more simple for us. That tends to put us inside. And many of us actually have an assumption that meditation is about going in. But it can be, and it should be, also going out. And in Satipatthana Sutta, it's very clear, inside and outside, because there really isn't a difference. But it's fine to sit here and close our eyes and explore the inner life, because we have to start somewhere. And that's fine, there's no problem with that. But we should just remember that it is a process that we've chosen to make a kind of slice of reality and explore that. And we do need to do that, like the body is a slice, prusa, of reality, which we say, here's my learning field. Here's where I'm going to be doing my learning right now. That's fine. But we should be aware that inside, mindfulness outside. Outside is the birds and the trees and the sky above. Outside is the food that we eat that we know comes from the stars and the earth and the water and the oceans, and we see it. Mindfulness, although it talks about, it encourages us to look at life more unconstructed, it is not bare, mechanical, like being a mindful computer. My computer is very mindful. It knows exactly what to do and when to do it. And when I press a button, it just does its thing. Mindfulness is actually full of values, arachim. Because without that, we actually don't have a direction. It's not just naked seeing. Sometimes mindfulness is called bare attention. It's not bare at all. It's actually rich. We already talked about a value that's helpful for us here in this retreat, which is the value of comfort or safety, reducing our primal existential insecurity. By feeling protected, feeling a sangha, feeling we're for each other here, feeling we're looked after and held, a sense of safety, refuge, miklat. That's one value. Another value is to be connected. It's helpful to realize how much we're connected. We're connected to the earth, we're connected to the trees, we're connected to the food, we're connected to each other. We may not be talking, but we can certainly feel that we're in one vessel here and we're connected. And mindfulness will show it to us. Another quality in mindfulness is remembering. Actually, the word in Pali, sati, means to remember. But the assumption is that we forget. So remembering and forgetting, coming and going, we do forget. That's okay. And we're not going down on ourselves because we forget. We suddenly find ourselves miles away from this retreat in Tel Aviv. What am I doing next week? Where am I going? What am I going to say to this person next week? Miles away from right here and now. That's okay. That's forgetting. But without judgment, without criticism, we know that mindfulness is about remembering to be aware, because we forget, because we go back into habits. And it's mind has a value of kindness, non-criticism. We're trying to undo the tendency for being under pressure, struggling, coping. That the basis of our issue of embodiment, of being in a body, is that we spend most of the time in the body coping. So kindness is a way in which we undo that tendency. We are kind whatever happens. We are our best friend. We are friends of ourselves and we are friends of each other. And it goes in the other direction. Life is not a struggle. And one other element I want to mention that is a value that's written into mindfulness is the value of knowing how to live through mindfulness or eranut or chbatiyut, being careful, taking care. It's another word, not sati, it's apamada, but it's in the same direction, taking care. How do we look after ourselves in life? We look after ourselves because we see what's good for us. If we don't see what's helpful, we don't know how to look after ourselves and how to look after others. So mindfulness is very close to a sense of guarding ourselves against harm, guarding others against harm. But for that we need to see what is helpful and what is harmful. So mindfulness is very close to ethics. And ethics are in there. That we bring goodness to the world and not harm. But for that we need mindfulness to know the difference. So mindfulness will lead us to the wisdom that we just talked about, the life point of view. In Pali, Yoniso Manikaram. And it's interesting that this word is it means wise attention, or attention that brings wisdom or insight. And it's a female quality. It has a female element to it. And the closest that I can think of in Hebrew for this kind of wisdom, apart from tovana, would be in the Kabbalah, the word bina. Not the word bina in modern Hebrew, but in the bina in traditional Hebrew. In Kabbalistic Hebrew, bina is a very high level of knowing. It's very female, it's intuitive, it's panoramic, it's a big seeing. It's impersonal. And it has in it love as connection, bina in the Kabbalah. So I want to explore a little bit with you. Why and how does this seeing give us a sense of freedom and space? How does it work? What's going on actually? If we kind of ask ourselves, how do we know anything at all? The answer is because we have senses, chushim, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the mind. It's in Buddhist psychology, the mind is a sense. It's a chush, brings information, for example, from memory. We have senses that are doorways to the world. Through these doorways or windows comes information, connecting us to the world. There's nothing wrong with that at all. There are our windows where we know the world. The problem is that we have become conditioned, conditioned to use the senses according to our interests. And so we become selective. I only know my head if I have a headache. If I don't have a headache, I can ignore my head. I only know walking if I go to retreat. Otherwise, the whole year I'm walking, I don't know I do one step. Because I don't need to know. I need to know to get to the shop. I don't need to know what my feet are doing to get to the shop. I just need to get to the shop. So this sense of switching off what is not relevant and just going according to my needs and interests, and that information I'm interested in through the senses, is a kind of spell, is kind of attachment or a spell, that we're just following the senses that follow our interests or our needs or our fears. So the Buddha had a very strong quote about this, which is quite scary, at least to me. It's like, wow, a shake-up quotation. He said in the earliest texts, one of the earliest texts is Sutta Nipata. It's really the very, very first texts that are known. He said, for some people, contact, the point where the senses meet an object, for some people this is enthralling, is the English, means a spell, is exciting, is capturing us. And so they are washed by the tides of being drifting along an empty, pointless road. That's a heavy one. But others come to understand the activity of their senses, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. So in other words, if we're controlled by our senses, I want this, I want that, I don't need this, I don't need that, survival, needs, interests, I go there, I go here, I go there, we are captured. And we're captured our whole life. And the Buddha said, it's an empty, pointless road. We feel just pushed along by life. Our senses just push us along. It's empty. But if we really look at the senses, we can find the delight, the stillness, and the awareness. So the senses are doorways that connect us to the world. There, through the senses, we can dance. We hear the birds and it touches us. We know a breath and we feel calmness. We walk and we touch the earth. We feel the wind on our face and we feel connected to the world. There is a quietness that begins to arise because we're connected to the world, we're not against the world. If the world and us are together through the senses, we will feel entirely quiet because there's no friction, ein chikuch. There's no fighting the world because of my needs. The world and me become one through the senses, and there is deep quiet and joy. I remember a retreat here not so long ago when it's also a big retreat like now. And on Friday afternoon, maybe it'll happen tomorrow as well, the muezzin from the local village was starting on top volume to shout. And some of us found it very disturbing here in the hall. Some people were rather shocked and felt kind of invaded and afraid. And it came up in the groups afterwards, and others were okay with it and just said, okay, well, there's a Dhamma talk in here and then there's another Dhamma talk over there. No problem. But some were not. And we used it as an opportunity to explore what comes through the senses that we can't control. If we have in us a place where we are disturbed, we are disturbable, then we will be disturbed. Life will invade. Life will disturb us. Life will disturb us and make us suffer because we are disturbable. Some were disturbed by the muezzin, some were not. No one could predict it, no one could control it. It just arrived in the middle of a deeply quiet meditation. So we need to be open, to be with the senses, with less processing of what's going on, to be the doorways to the world. Clean the doors of perception, said William Blake. The doors of perception are the senses. Clean them, and I forget the quote, clean the doors of perception, do you remember it? And you will see life as it really is, namely infinite. Our doors of perception, that's what we're doing here. We're cleaning them. We're making them clean to be like a window to the world inside and outside, without processing, without a me in there, without closing ourselves in this me inside. There was a personal story about this which was really very clear to me at the time. Years ago, I was walking in the mountains in the Alps, and I was walking and walking and walking, and it was the afternoon. I had to get home. I was miles away from the village, the Swiss village, and it was the afternoon. I couldn't go back, and I was walking. All of a sudden, the path I was walking became a zug on one side, a cliff. And it was really, really deep, steep down, kilometer down on one side. And all of a sudden, I began to feel fear of heights, which I had from my childhood, very, very strong. But there was other side, there were bushes and so on, so it didn't matter. So I kind of went a little bit towards the bushes. After another 100 meters, the other side dropped. And I was walking on a ridge, because they're on a path that was like this wide, and down here was a tzuk, and down here was a tzuk, a cliff, and I was walking on. And I collapsed. I felt nausea, dizzy, I nearly fainted, I couldn't do it. And it all came back, the fear, from way back, way, way, way back, of heights. So I was on the floor, my face on the earth, and I thought, wait a minute, this is not a very dignified way to... What would the Buddha do right now? He certainly wouldn't be there lying down on the path. So I got up and I remembered this teaching about senses. And I decided I would walk without processing any information through the senses. In other words, the idea that this was a tzuk, was a cliff with kilometer down, is a thought, and it's frightening, is a thought, is a memory, is a conditioned, it's a habit. But supposing I just saw colors down there, were just a spot of red, houses down there, trees down there, colors, red, green. Supposing I just didn't process anything. Bli ibud, which is no processing. And it worked. And I could walk and walk and walk as long as I kept the concentration. As soon as there became a moment when I sort of, it's a kilometer down, collapsed. So this sense of being connected to the world through the senses, which are cleaning the senses to connect us to the world simply, without processing, without a self in control, without issues around it, without commenting, without needs or choices or interests that dominate. So I want to finish with a story from the text, the Bahia Sutta. And it really is about this, exactly about this. And this is a short, powerful teaching of the Buddha on liberation. And it's short and it's powerful because the guy that came to ask the Buddha for the teaching told the Buddha, I have no time. You have to give me the teaching now. So he was from South India, Bahia. And he was a kind of great guru, and he lived in the beach in South India, and he thought he was enlightened. But a little doubt kind of was nagging him. And so he asked the gods, tell me, am I enlightened? All the villagers keep coming to me and asking me for teaching, so they think I'm enlightened. Am I enlightened or maybe not? And the gods answered him, absolutely not. And so he said, so what do I do? And the God said to him, go to the north of India. There's a man there who will help you. Gautama. So he kind of grabbed himself and he ran to the north of India. He walked 3,000 kilometers or 4,000 kilometers to the north of India, non-stop more or less. Didn't it says in the story, he didn't sleep more than one night in the same place, and eventually arrived to the Buddha, and the Buddha was collecting food. And worth remembering that the Buddhists at that time just, and this is about the story, about not being full of our self-interest, they ate what they were given. They didn't make choices, they didn't select. Oh, I wonder how the food is today. I wonder if the cook's really... I'm waiting for the dal and rice. Oh, why didn't they put enough salt in? None of that. Whatever is in your... someone slops in in your bowl nothing but white rice, as happens to a lot of monks in Thailand today, that's what you have. So anyway, the Buddha was going around with the monks from house to house in the village collecting food for his meal. They ate once a day, the early monks. And he said to Bahia, sorry, I can't give you teaching now because my time for teaching is in the afternoon. And now I'm collecting food. So Bahia said, I don't have time, I don't have time, you have to tell me now. And the Buddha said, no, I can't. But he asked three times, and then the Buddha said, okay, since you asked three times, I'll tell you. But it's going to be a short teaching, and take it to heart. This is it. So this is what he said. In the seen, what is seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, what is heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only the sensed. In the thought or cognized, there is only the cognized. Thus, you should see that indeed there is no thing there. There is no thing here, sorry. Indeed, there is no thing here. This, Bahia, is how you should train yourself. It's just seeing. There's no thing here. It's just cognition. It's just, there's no thing. Just what the eye, the appearances of the world are arriving here. No thing. There's no, the whole retreat is not in my head. All of you guys are not in my head right now. Your appearances arriving into my senses. Since Bahia, there is for you in the seen only what is seen, in the heard only what is heard, in the sensed, touch, only what is sensed, in the cognized, only the cognized. And you see that there is no thing here. And you will also see that indeed there is no thing there. As you see that there is no thing there, you will see that you are therefore located neither in the world of this, nor in the world of that, nor in any place between the two. And this is the end of suffering. So in a way, it's just sensing is happening. We are not there and not here. Senses are just the senses show us the world. Doorways, there's no things here and there's no things there. It's just appearances coming through the sense doors. And where are we? The world and us are together. Where are we? There, here. Where am I? As in the poem at the beginning. We're in the stars, we're in the seas, we're in the sun, we're in the water. That's where we are. Okay, we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.